Yeah. Welcome to the motherfucking Soulcast. Today's guests are Nick Montgomery and Carla Bergman, and we'll be talking about their new book, or maybe it's not that new. It's new to me. Joyful Militancy, that came out on AK Press via the Institute for Anarchist Studies. This book is a very, very important intervention into quote-unquote activist or quote-unquote radical culture, sort of examining the kind of toxic currents that run through it, that run through our thinking in these settings, and they provide like a framework for talking about and thinking about these antisocial behaviors that continue to emerge within activist settings. And again, this framework, or as they say, pathways to sort of working through these and, you know, killing that sad militant in your head. And, you know, part of that is thinking about trust and friendship as a radical formation and what is joy. And I just, I mean, I know I say that, but it's like I don't cover books. I don't bother, you know, reading hundreds of pages unless I really fucking love it. And this book really rocked my world. It rocked my world in the same way that, like, To Our Friends by Invisible Committee and other books like that have just rocked my world and just, like, and so to people listening to this, you know, this podcast, go pick up that book. And, you know, I think it's a good book for reading groups. I think it's a good book to read with friends and talk about the shit that they're talking about in this book, because it really gets at the heart of this kind of fucked up, unhealthy shit that we just see all the time when we engage in social struggles. And, you know, that shit's gotta go. That is not the way to be, you know, being judgmental, paranoid, standoffish, an asshole. Like, fuck that shit. It's 2019. The world is burning. Fascists are rising, and we gotta reach out. We gotta build with each other. We gotta be cool in the face of all this shit. This music in the background is my fucking homie Picture Plane. And, you know, I chose this because, A, this is like one of the best beats ever made. And because I feel like what was going on at the Rhinoceropolis and like the currents that run through Picture Plane's music also represent that joyful militancy that we need to see in the world. And speaking of Denver, I want to send a huge shout out to the Denver Anarchist Black Cross. You know, when I was coming up as a young, actually I wasn't young, but as I was coming up through organizing, you know, the Denver Anarchist Black Cross played such an important and vital role in the movement work and in my own political development. And, you know, it's still going strong. So to all the people in Denver who are listening to this podcast, they've started doing letter writing nights again. Maybe they never stopped. I don't know. I haven't been there. But I hooked on Colfax on February 13th, 7 p.m. They'll be doing a political prisoner letter writing thing. And just in general, if you're in Denver and you don't follow the Denver Anarchist Black Cross, go to some events, check out the work they're doing, because, you know, they're awesome people. And, you know, last but not least, I will say that this podcast continues to grow. It's crazy, you know, all the feedback I've been getting on it over the past few months, and just like realizing that this is, you know, one of the longest standing radical podcasts out there. And that's cool. That's awesome. And it's awesome, the people who've been with this since the beginning, to watch it grow. So, you know, at this point in my work, just trying to keep it going, keep it growing. And if people want to support this work, if people want to help me continue to do this work in a sustainable way, please consider signing up on Patreon at patreon.com/SOLEONE. You can sign up for $2 a month or $5 a month. You know, basically like a cup of coffee is $5. And You know, you can make coffee at home and listen to the Soulcast. I'm in the process of planting this little fruit orchard, nut orchard, and all this shit over here. And, you know, could use a little some pennies in the motherfucking tip jar, if you know what I mean. So it's all the people who support this podcast and listen. Thank you. Much love. And if you're one of the awesome people who supports this financially, I appreciate you. Thank you. My son thanks you. And so before we get into this, let's hear from some homies in the Channel Zero Podcast Network.
Hi, my name's Eamon Farrelly, and I have a podcast. How original, right? It's called Radical People, and it's about radical people. Basically, I sit down and I interview people who I find very interesting. Interesting why? Interesting because they took a look at the world around them, saw a need, saw a problem perhaps, and they decided to address that need or fix that problem. How? With direct action. That's right, not by begging the dirty government and its politicians and bureaucrats, and not by lobbying corporations to please, please, please stop being so awful. No, they get together with some comrades or some homies or just whoever, and they implement whatever solution they see fit, however they see fit to do it. So, that's my podcast. I listen to these people's stories, which turn out to be sometimes very funny, sometimes very scary, sometimes harrowing, always edifying, sometimes titillating. Actually, I haven't had one yet that's been titillating. I know, like, making things a little sexed up generally sells, but typically when people are, those are ISIS soldiers, it doesn't get as sexy as you think. Or maybe it does, and they just haven't told me that part yet. So anyway, you should listen to my podcast if you just happen to be really bored, or on a road trip, or you just need to drown out what's going on around you. Check out Radical People by searching for it on iTunes, SoundCloud, or by checking out the Channel Zero Network. That's my commercial for my show. Thank you for listening to my commercial for my show.
And when we die, we will die with our hearts on back.
Nick Montgomery and Carla Bergman, welcome to the Soulcast.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
You know, it's my pleasure. It's been really fun living with this book for the last couple months. And, you know, I like read books really slow and like really try to, you know, let them rattle around in my little tin can brain while I read them. And, it's been awesome. So thanks for writing it.
Thanks for reading.
Yeah,
I appreciate it.
That's great.
So y'all are, in Vancouver right now.
Yeah,
that's right.
Vancouver,
yeah.
Canada.
Yeah, I live in Victoria, but I'm visiting Carla and her family.
Nice. Lots of good food in Vancouver. Last time I went there, I feel like I got a lot of good Asian food, like Thai. And
totally. Yeah. It's pretty cosmopolitan when it comes to cuisine.
The Pacific Northwest is just so special. Like BC, I always like expect to see a dinosaur like stick its head out of a lake or something, you know?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's just something about the scale. It's like so lush, but then the mountains are so big and I don't know.
And the ocean. Yeah. The combinations.
It's a pretty epic place.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's awesome. One of my favorite memories going there is just like taking a ferry through a mountain lake. And I was like, what planet am I on right now? A boat up in the mountains? Like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Cool. When was the last time you were here?
I don't even know. Maybe 2013.
Okay.
So I played some shitty show with like Juggalos, and it was it was, you know, there was some mixed consciousness going on that night. I'll put it that way.
Mm-hmm. But I hear ya.
Hey, it was, you know, whatever. It's cool. It's always fun to cross the border.
Yeah.
So this new book. Or this book, Joyful Militancy, Building Thriving Resistance in Toxic Times. I know this is an obvious question, but why did you write this book?
Yeah, we're doing the pointing at each other thing. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why we wrote the book. I like to share just a brief story of, because it goes back quite a few years, of why joy became this this kind of concept or notion that was really important to me with regards to my politics and how I engaged in the world. It was probably around 2000. I was taking philosophy and reading Spinoza, and I'm no expert on Spinoza, but he talks a lot about this idea of joy, and just other things that were going on in my life. It was a really challenging time. A lot of trauma was happening in our lives, and I just kept noticing that I had this capacity for joy, or this thing that was happening that was making me have more capacity, and I kept coming back to this idea of joy. And so it became this word or concept that I brought to a lot of the things I did in life, particularly in activism and organizing. You know, I almost became militant about joy and thinking of all the ways that we could talk about it that's different than, say, happiness. So that's where that started. And then come ahead 10 years, maybe 10 or 11 years, I was interviewing Richard Day for a film I was making. And actually, the reality is we were interviewing each other for our films. So he was actually interviewing me about the project that I was part of called the Purple Thistle Center, which was a youth-run arts and activism center in Vancouver that ran for 15 years. And I was telling him about all the different ways we organize and what we do there. And he said, it sounds like joyful militancy to me. And I just peaked. My interest was so peaked. I was like, what is this joyful militancy? And that's where that real seed got planted. And I had met Richard through Nick. I guess it was 2011 after we met.
Right.
And so it just was this thing that ignited between Nick and I right away. And then... maybe Nick can talk about why he wanted to write it, because I could go on forever. But
yeah, I mean, for me, I think it was the thing that I was originally got really interested in was the thing that isn't joyful militancy, the rigid radicalism piece, because I think I started to realize that I was pretty steeped in that, in like the anarchist-y, activist-y subculture that I had been a part of, and that I had really internalized that there's this right way to be radical, and it means like mastering this complex language and saying the right things and performing the right things and like doing radical actions. And I was like a pretty judgy person, and maybe wasn't even super aware of that. I was just like, well, I'm a radical. This is what it means to be radical. And I came and met Carla and a bunch of other folks involved in the Purple Thistle when they did the Purple Thistle Institute, like, I don't know what year, like 8 or 9 years ago. And I knew about the Thistle, and I thought it was a really cool project, and that it was, I thought it was really neat that it was this like youth run space that was kind of anarchist-y, and they had been involved in anti-Olympics organizing. And so in my kind of like, I'm super radical, judgy mode, they had checked off all the boxes, and I thought, okay, they qualify as radicals in my world, and yet they're talking about kindness and generosity as being at the center of their practice, and not only talking about it, but like doing it, like being really generous with each other and being really kind, and seeing that as like not like a nice thing that you stick on top of your politics, but like something at the core. And that was just really impactful for me. And it made me rethink some of the commitments that I had, and like, what is radical, and what's radical even about. And we ended up, I talked with all kinds of people about this, and Carla and I ended up in a bunch of conversations about it. And then we were kind of like, oh, maybe we could write about this.
Yeah, and I should add that the real seed came from Cindy Milstein. Like, she suggested that we put in a grant for the IAS. And that, you know, when you all of a sudden are going to go for this external body or to your peer, like ICIS is our, you know, our sort of anarchisty peers, right, in publishing, and like you're going to send this thing, it makes you really think about it. So originally we were going to write just an essay. And so we put in a grant and received a small grant, which helped me with paying for childcare so I could do some of this research and interviews. So we did that for the first year and then realized that this was way bigger than a 3,000 word essay, and went back to IAS and asked if we could turn it into a book. And they said yes. And so it was from 2013 until like January 2017 that we worked on this book.
Mm-hmm. Wait, how long? 4 years?
3.5.
Okay. Wow, that is a long time to work on a book.
Yeah. And the first year and a half was thinking about the essay and doing interviews and talking to, I mean, my other life is I'm a kind of like a community engaged artist. So that is what they would call it. I'd put it in quotes, but a lot of my artistic or creative projects, I really believe in, like, you do the research with people, your friends, and with your community, and you go and you talk to them before you write it. So it was kind of my practice in place already, and it suited Nick's style as well. So the actual writing was maybe a year, mm-hmm. I would say. Hey,
yeah.
I mean, what I love about the fact that it's written by two people is that you can tell there's just like, you know, you're ruthlessly, you know, I don't want to say ruthlessly critiquing, but you can tell that like you're really thinking about, you know, the depth of like all the different ways this work could be perceived, and, you know, like having to overcome a certain amount of like, 'cause me, like I've felt a lot of this stuff before, and when like, but it always made me feel like a liberal or something when I was around like more hardened anarchist types who like are like, you know, why would you want to do that? Why are you guys laughing? Like, we're supposed to be pissed off right now, you know? And so it like, I love that it, I don't know, that it just provides like a vocabulary for like analyzing and processing these experiences, but a set of tools to kind of move beyond it. So I guess, could you talk a little bit more about what rigid radicalism is?
Sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess the first thing is one of the things that we tried really hard to do was to not turn it into an it, which is it's like kind of a convoluted thing, but basically we didn't want to reduce it to a set of specific behaviors. Like, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. Don't be mean. Don't call people out. Don't be cold, et cetera, et cetera. And wanted to instead think about it as a process in the language of our book. Like, think about it as something that's affective. Like, it works at the level of how we feel and how we desire. And it's also constantly shifting, right? So in a specific situation, it's whatever kind of rigid ideal ends up policing each other, where something gets invented about the right way to be radical. And that can look totally different in different radical milieus, you know. In some, it's maybe being super cool and never being caught off guard and never being naive and kind of being a really great intellectual. In other milieus, it's maybe like having the best anti-oppressive language or doing the most radical actions. So it can take a different shape, but in every case, it's like whatever ends up creating a mold that ends up policing our behavior and limiting what we can do together.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you like, one of the things I really like, this is something Scott Crow has talked about, but I'd like to hear, I like the way you put it in this book, like the Christian origins of rigid radicalism. Can you talk about like that as being one of the like influences of rigid radicalism or possible origins?
Sure. I'll probably get Nick to talk more about this, but I just wanted to also add that the term rigid radicalism is very much just a placeholder. Like, because, you know, you need a term so that to talk about things in a book, even joyful militancy in a way is a placeholder for something we're getting at in terms of being open and curious and transformative with each other. So the same goes with rigid radicalism. And so when we were trying to think about ways to talk about it in the book, we didn't want to prescribe or give a toolkit on how to not be rigid. So we wanted to come up with three stories about the ways we think that rigid radicalism takes hold. And those are paranoid reading or schooling, ideology, and then morality or Christian morality. And I'm going to get Nick to talk a bit more about, I mean, we really talk the difference between like an ethics versus a morality, but I'll get Nick to talk about it in more detail.
Yeah, I think, one of the people that helped us think and write about morality was Nietzsche, and his critique of Christian morality, it has its roots in Christianity, but then I think the important piece is he talks about how it becomes secularized, and so it's not necessarily about the religion. But it's about a shift that starts to take place in Western civilization, where instead of starting from what are your values and what makes you feel alive and what are you about, it starts from an external, hostile, shitty, sinful world, and that external world is bad and we are sinful and bad because we're part of it. And the way that we're good is kind of this after effect. We're good because we see all the shittiness and because we preach about it and tell others about it and resist it or do something about it, or save other people from sin. And so it's that kind of the way that then gets secularized that we wanted to talk about, that there's still that kind of, structure that can take place in activist communities that don't have anything to do with Christianity, but still maybe partake of all those ideas of like a bad, shitty, sinful world out there that really ends up defining us and what we're about rather than starting from our own values.
Yeah. Our own collective's values, our own community's values, mm-hmm. too, like sort of thinking about it outside of just the individual act.
Right on. And as you were mentioning schooling, you know, one of the things I liked in the book was, you know, talking about how, like, you know, we're all fucked up. We're already, you know, just tainted by the whole process. I mean, I'm making up my own shit here, but how, like, you know, whatever. But then when you watch kids, you know, they haven't yet learned their limitations. They haven't. You know, they haven't been told that they haven't been warned about capitalism yet, you know. And so, like, the part in the book where they were talking about, you know, learning from the joy of kids, I thought that was cool. And so it makes me want to ask you what, like, about the role schooling plays in this analysis of rigid radicalism,
right.
Quote-unquote.
I mean, yeah, we could do a whole interview on school and school resistance.
Well, we're going to, but.
Right.
But
yes, you know, we will one day.
Give us a teaser.
A little teaser. I mean, it's interesting because I think the majority of us have been schooled. And what that looks like is that right away, when we enter school, there is a notion that we are told that there's kind of a competition at place. There's a scarcity of there's only going to be so many good people, good, smart kids. And, you know, we all have to, we get kind of hierarchized really early on in school. So that's just happening right away. So you imagine that getting embodied over time, no matter what's going on, maybe outside of your life, like that's the schooled mind is that, like, things have to be given to you. It's not intrinsic. What else? I don't know. Like, it's just.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I think it was part of what led to me to internalize some of that rigid radical stuff, because it's about figuring out what the right thing to do is and like doing it well, or resisting it, but in a kind of just like fuck you kind of way instead of a let's build something together kind of way.
Yeah, so it's the binary that we can kind of fall into of school or not school, which just gets us into a kind of rigid camp on both sides. I was definitely a school resistor from a really young age. So that what Nick says really speaks to me of somebody who was fighting against it. And it wasn't until I had my own child that I realized that, really my anti-authoritarian way of like articulation of being in the world or anarchist or whatever you want to call it, came through parenting. It came through the relationship with a younger person. I learned it in an embodied way. And then when we started talking about schooling for him, and seeing what was happening with him in school, like just up close and personal, it was like, there has to be another option than school resistance or school. And that got me into the world, the amazing world of like creating all the alternatives to school, which I think is the important piece versus just alternative schools, which often replicate all kinds of problems and hierarchy societies and liberalism and individualism and moralism. And, so I think like the school question is really huge, but the parts that come out into activism that I really see are the notions of scarcity, not material scarcity, but scarcity of like being the smart one, the bright one, the leader, the charismatic leader, and then competition. Just that idea of like just being fiercely competitive with each other really gets rooted in school.
Yeah, it's so, my school experience is a total nightmare, but... You know, anyway, so I've been like an unschooled adult, basically.
Right. Yeah. You're not alone.
But like I saw you were reading Carla, you had posted on Twitter that you were like rereading The Dispossessed, you know?
Yes.
And, the definitely like the opposite of joy on, NRAs and, in my liberal, definition. It like when I was reading the stuff about school and rigid radicalism, I was like feeling like things in myself, like how as anarchists or anti-authoritarians, we're trying to like, you know, resist that competitive nature. Yet I know for a fact I have felt competitive with other anarchist groups in when I was organizing in Denver and other groups. And it really, like reading that part really made me like analyze, like find that, that in myself and be like, wow, that really, like I thought I'd, you know, whatever, decolonized my mind or whatever, but here's these like capitalistic impulses creeping in through, this supposed to be liberatory work. And I'm like, no wonder we didn't, no wonder Denver didn't secede, you know,
right.
There's a lot of that shit going on.
Right. So. Yeah. It's true that those lies are deep about like socially that we have scarcity. That's just ridiculous. That's like saying that there's a scarcity of love. Like it's just, I think that, you know, there's really rare cases where people are isolated and like they have maybe a scarcity of love, but like, you know, in our thriving big cities where we're doing lots of activism, like this idea that we have to be competitive and with each other because there's not, you know, there's only so many people that can be radical or so many people who can be seen. It's just, I think, one of the biggest lies that we're told really early on, or maybe not even told, but experiencing really early on in our systems of education and other institutions that really cluster our imaginations. They just hide us away from the possibilities.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We walk into the world a question mark and we leave a period. I think they say that about school, but what are some positive examples of what joyful militancy in action looks like outside of disasters, but like in organizing spaces, or maybe not necessarily in organizing spaces, but, or not necessarily, but like, yeah, what does joyful militancy look like in action?
Well, I mean, one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot lately, and I don't know how much of this has traveled down to the U.S., but one of the things that is on the minds of a lot of my friends and the people that I know is the Unistoten camp, which is a camp in kind of central or northern B.C. On Wet'suwet'en territory that for the last almost decade, they've been blocking a series of pipelines and not just stopping the construction, but in the process building a healing lodge and a permaculture center or permaculture garden. And in the summers, they hosted these action camps for the last 5 or 6 years. And I only went up to one of them, but that was a place where I really felt like a lot of these values are being embodied, partly because it's just really inspiring to see militant Indigenous people who are like kind of putting their lives on the line to protect the place where they live. And also seeing settlers, like non-Indigenous people, show up in really meaningful solidarity. And like some people had been there for several months, and it felt to me like, of course there's all the shit that still shows up. Like there's all kinds of difficult dynamics and impressive stuff that's happening. But in the midst of that, it felt to me at least like there's also this spirit that it's just really obvious that that this struggle is more important than the petty little conflicts that can often arise between people. And that it felt like that was just a spirit that was really strong in that space. And that's something that I noticed and then started to ask, how could cities be more like those spaces? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think for me, I mean, and we write about it in the book, and I've made a whole film about it, my experience with the purple thistle, whether it was stuff that we did at the center itself with the youth or even some of the institutes or summits that we did, some social spaces summits where we invited folks in from anywhere, really, but mostly from North America to come, who ran social spaces to come and, like, chew on these ideas. And one of the things that was really exciting about all those experiences at the Thistle was that a real commitment to militancy or to radicalism was just always, it was always a part of the project and it was always centered, but right alongside it was this idea to thrive. And I mean, thriving in like the really deep way, like it's not the individualistic thriving, but like thriving as a community of care, whether it was informal, taking care of each other when things would come up, instead of calling the cops, we called each other to bringing food when someone's ill. And I think that's like the most experienced way I've lived it. That's not attached to like an ongoing struggle or a disaster situation. So like an everyday life. And I think that like, yeah, in our book, we do some interviews and it's just like little pieces for Gustavo Esteva and Marina Sertin. Both of them, we have the full interviews on our website, joyfulmilitancy.com.
I think so.
They both talk about a lot of examples, and I really recommend people go check them out. They do a lot of Latin American stuff, which is really a big part of where the imagination. I mean, these ideas, a lot of the ideas in the book really can point back to the Zapatistas. So I really recommend reading up on those examples because they are just so beautiful.
You talk in the book about conviviality and disasters and how people come together in natural disasters as like examples also of joyful militancy. Can you talk about some examples?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like there's been a whole bunch of even more recent examples than when we wrote the book. Like the hurricane that hit Puerto Rico, and in Houston, there's been a whole bunch of grassroots disaster relief where people are showing up and figuring out together in a grassroots way what needs to happen and supporting each other. And we were drawing on, again, our interview with Gustavo Esteva, but also Rebecca Solnit's book about disasters.
Paradise Built in Hell.
Paradise Built in Hell. And part of what we ended up getting at and becoming really wanting to emphasize is that part of why we think people are able to show up and feel so alive and connected in disasters is that industrial infrastructure, like the way that we're kind of strapped into this industrial way of life, is really isolating. And that's part of what's to blame for, like, why we're not doing this all the time, why we feel separated, and also why we, not just separated from each other, but why we can't take responsibility for, like, where does our shit go? Where does our water come from? Where does our food come from? We can't ask those questions because we're just strapped into these industrial supply chains where we're not able to take responsibility for that. And then when people can, when those systems get interrupted by disaster, that's really enabling for people. It's really exciting because all of a sudden, like, oh, I can actually do these things and I feel more capable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Scott Crow talks about this in his book, Black Flags. I can't remember the title.
Yeah, sorry, that was it. Black Flags.
Sorry, but... I think that's a really, I mean, his, that stuff in New Orleans, right, is like one of the best examples.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. All this book, like this conversation, it really reminds me, like, I had the chance to visit this place in France called Tarnac, a couple times. And a lot of the people who live there are kind of inspired by the work of the Invisible Committee and Tikkun and those works. And they've like taken over this medieval town, not taken over, but like a whole bunch of them settled this medieval town. You know, when I went there, I just saw, like, you know, permaculture gardens. Like, it's a town in the middle of nowhere, but they bring in like political music artists to play shows there. And like, you don't think anybody's going to be there, but then you play a show and it feels like Paris in 01 and people are going crazy. And it's like, how is this, like, this new way of being even possible? Like, I never could imagine like a sort of intellectual hub in the woods surrounded with nature and all these radicals flowing in and out of there. And it just like blew my mind about what was possible. And like, one of the things that really like stuck with me there is they were building structures for Syrian refugees to live in. And I was like, aren't you worried about, you know, the potentials of like patriarchal bullshit that could possibly come with like letting strangers with an entirely different set of values, like, you know, move here, you know? And they were like, we have to keep our projects radically open, you know? And it's what they kind of learned through like Lazad. And the struggles there were like, you know, and even the same thing with the Keystone XL pipeline, like definition of a radical environmentalist is a right-wing conservative who's having a pipeline built on their property. And it just like, it just struck me how keeping things like radically open and just being open to chance and open to possibilities is kind of like all we got, you know, like that's our only chance to really, I think, to break through this stuff.
Yeah. Right on. That's cool that you got to go there. I'd love to go there.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'd be happy to put you in touch with the person who welcomes me there. And I'm sure that they would love to have you there. I've actually heard this book referenced on, a podcast, about the Invisible Committee. I don't know if you knew that, but
no,
yeah. The, new books in critical theory, like towards the end, after they were done doing like a whatever 2-hour special on To Our Friends, they were like, and you know, you really should check out Joyful Militancy to get a better idea of what what we're talking about or something. And I was
that's
nice. Yeah, that's cool.
That's cool. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I feel like there's some, I mean, are y'all into that stuff? Does that influence, did any of that, like, to our friends kind of stuff influence? I notice you're saying forms of life a lot in the book. is that stuff like inspiring y'all?
Yeah, for sure. I think, the Invisible Committee was really helpful in understanding how you can, like, weaponize Spinoza, I think. Like, they took affect theory through, like, de Kooning and both the Invisible Committee books, and really, I think, a lot of our ideas about how empire is about affective control, and that, like, creating alternatives to it or fighting it is about... it's like a battle that involves how we feel and our desires, and not just like what we think and what our ideology is. We cite them throughout the book. It really helped us think through that kind of stuff.
Yeah, for sure. And it also inspired a lot of the Thistle Youth about when did Coming Insurrection come out? Anyways, it really inspired a lot of the young people in my life. And one of the... It definitely played a role in wanting to do the book in the way that we did it, in terms of amplifying a lot of people's voices who are doing the work or maybe not heard as much, and bringing some of these sort of loftier ideas down to earth a bit. Not that, I don't know if we do that super well. We kind of stay up in the theory as well. But I definitely was inspired by their work, and definitely I would say more their project than their work for me.
Mm. Right on. I mean, to me, like, reading To Our Friends for me was a huge, like, intervention in my thinking. I was like, oh, I need to rethink a whole bunch of stuff. And I feel like this kind of picks up almost from a more, like, you know, not from a more emotional aspect. It's that it's an intervention in the same way. And so the same way we had reading groups for To Our Friends, I wish I would love to reread this book with some friends and just, like, talk about it, because I feel like it's an important intervention in what we're trying to do. So thank you.
We actually tried to interview them for our book, and
good luck with that.
They sent us back an email and said, well, the Invisible Committee isn't a thing that can be interviewed. So.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, they're great. And I also think that, you know, we wanted to bring it a little bit down to earth.
Isn't a thing that can be interviewed. I love it. I love that shit. Well, okay. So you talk about how we are socialized, and we kind of talked about this a little bit, but how we were socialized in a way that doesn't make us healthy socially. And I've noticed, like, I have homies who have backgrounds in churches, and they're like, you know, they have this, like, really great ability. I'm thinking of my friends, the Flowbots, who I feel like we've done some joyfully militant shit together with, like, music and chanting and sort of, like, stuff like that. But they, like when I get in front of a crowd and, like, or when I'm in a room trying to talk to people, like, I try to be cool and relaxed, but I'm really uncomfortable, you know? Whereas, like, people, I feel like, who come from a church setting just have this, like, magical ability to just be warm because they've seen, like, these awesome preachers, like, moving people. And so I'm just wondering, like, what do you think are skills or communities that have more to offer to remedy the sort of toxic activist culture that is unwelcoming and cold? Like, what kind of skills could we be refining that could help us in these settings?
Yeah, it's interesting because we work really hard in our book. I don't know if you noticed, to not have, like, a list of to-dos or skill, you know, prescriptions. That's made, I think, some people really happy, and then of course it's upset some of the folks who are more interested in wanting strategies, and, like, big M movement builders don't like that. They want to hear what to do.
12-point program to full emotional and liberation.
And I think so. I'm hesitant to respond. I mean, I think that there's definitely you're going to find these skills in a lot of Christian environments that are more on the progressive left side of things, that like doing an intersectionality look at life around race and stuff. Then you're going to see a lot of these concepts and ideas that we're taught, themes of ways of being in the world. You know, you can see them in their communities. But I want to say that I don't think it's something that pedagogically needs to be taught. I think that's like the antithesis to what we're getting at. I remember people used to always say to me about the thistle, like, do you give a class on how to do consensus or democracy? And to me, it's like, you know, it's the opposite of that, right? Like, it's something incredible happens when, you're just probably going to laugh because this is like kind of like anarchism 101, but like the conditions really will set the tone. So I don't mean it's like a flimsy, do whatever you want. There should be some scaffolding in place, but I don't know. I think if you just have a space that's based on taking care of each other and relationship based, I don't know, it's just centering each other, sending the human connection, then all this other stuff is going to happen. I don't know. Does that make sense? Should I restate it?
Well, do you feel like talking about trust or responsibility?
Yeah, I think that's the problem.
Can I say it again? Let's go. Let's do it. Like, you know, as you're using these words like trust and responsibility, maybe it's useful to like define them as your, like, you know, what you mean by
the
trust,
way that we define
what you
them.
Mean by responsibility.
Cause right. I guess the first thing I want to say to activists, like, I think when it's not life or death and we're not on the front lines of disasters, like a lot of these behaviors come up in, let's face it, really white spaces, right? So when like life isn't, like, I think we put too many high stakes on what we're doing, or we make it bigger than it is. And it's kind of, when we have these kind of experimental spaces that we're running and we're trying to do it differently, I think we can just maybe calm down a little bit and look to each other and trust each other more. And I mean trust in not the kind of trust maybe you'd have with a long-term friend or a partner, but like just trusting people up front to like that they're bringing their best selves and that they're going to do well by each other. And something really incredible happens when you start from a place of trust. And alongside that, you have to have responsibility. So what that looks like is giving people, like sharing the responsibility of running the space, of showing up for each other, of taking care of each other. And not having a rigid list of things that have to be done to be part of the group. So we kind of didn't come up with it, but we break down the word of responsibility. So like thinking about our capacities and the ability to respond. And that's going to look different for, say, like the 14-year-old kid that's showing up to the project versus the 23-year-old. The 23-year-old probably has a bit more capacity to be more responsible. Or just has more access to more time or whatever. That's just an example. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, like, I just really think I'm allergic to and want to avoid giving instructions on how to not treat each other badly. And instead of saying like, let's start from a place of care and trust.
Well, I'll tell you, all the Maoists who listen to this podcast are going to be fucking pissed at that answer.
Sorry, Maoist.
You know what? It's not just the Maoist. The people who just don't like our book, I mean, they're across the left. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just kidding.
It's true, though.
Hey, buddy.
There you go. Also say look to children, right? Like, look to children. Children just, like, they embody this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, what? Like, I don't know how I would use that for radical practice. I'd be like just obsessing about trucks and choo-choo trains a lot right now in my activism.
Yeah, bring in the trucks and choo-choo trains.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot to be said for having some play.
Yeah, no, I was just actually thinking like, oh, you know, actually we had fun building these little train tracks. Like maybe that's, you know. I'm half kidding, but like little things like that, like along those lines, it just made me think of one of my favorite things I did, was after like the Antifa stuff started popping off. I was like, you know what? A lot of these vegans look like they, you know, I've just watched like Trump supporters just slapping the shit out of everybody. And I was like, all right, like, let's get some self-defense classes going. And we got a local MMA gym to offer free private classes, and we put it out there to groups that, that we didn't really work that well with, like the local Black Lives Matter chapter and other kind of feminist groups, to just so that it wouldn't just be like the typical anarchist crew in there, so that like, and it was just really nice, just everybody kind of sweating together and doing something really physical together that didn't involve like calling each other out for like whatever, or avoiding each other because we don't share the same politics. It was like, no, we're just gonna sweat together. And that, I thought that was,
that's awesome.
Yeah. That's like an example of joyful militancy right there.
Totally. And conviviality.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important that you got to do shit together, not just sit around and have meetings, but like do creative stuff together. I think one of the, you know, there's, I think some of the most successful spaces probably have an art part to it, mm-hmm. running alongside it. Right. So they might be doing lots of other, organizing and involvement in different types of, actions in their city or beyond, but usually maybe what's running alongside is an art practice that's community based or like collaborative based, whether they're making films or screen printing or whatever. Like there's an element of play and creativity and curiosity that is just super important.
Like an image that just popped in my mind is like one of the first times I met one of the Crime Think people, they were up at the front of a show, like just dancing like mad. And I was like, I'm going to like this person. You know, I don't like, I may be a really stiff hanging up against the wall, like not dancing, but this person is like writing, participating in all this awesome writing. And then there they are dancing with these like college sorority white girls. And I'm like, well, this is awesome. Like,
That's awesome.
What a cool person.
I want to add though, like for the fellow, wallflowers out there, that you can be a joyful militant and be a wallflower. There's all kinds of ways to incite and inspire joy and militancy that doesn't require extroverted kind of energetic stuff.
Yeah, right on. Like, yeah. we don't all have to be.
Yeah.
I don't have rhythm in my body. You know, sorry. Or that's not how I choose to express myself. It doesn't mean I,
right.
you know, I, yeah, whatever. I could just talk a whole bunch of shit right now. But, okay. Here's another term that keeps popping up in the book. I heard about this term from Anthony Negri, and it kind of, it's empire. So how do you define empire in this book? And, yeah. How do you define empire?
Yeah, I mean, I think for us, we were drawing a bit on Antonio Negri and Michael Hart in their book Empire, but also like, I don't know why exactly, but Invisible Committee, I guess, has picked them as like their intellectual enemies, even though they have quite a similar definition of empire. And we were drawing on the Invisible Committee also, and maybe trying to make it a bit more accessible than the way that they talk about it, but trying to include the things that are maybe more familiar to a North American audience, that it's all the forms of fuckery and oppression and violence, like the state and capitalism and heteropatriarchy and white supremacy and colonization, that is like, that's part of what we wanted to include. But in addition to those things that are, you know, like directly threatening lives, directly exploiting people, oppressing people in ways that like people do not want to get shot, to get killed, to get exploited. It also works in this other way that we use the term subjection, that it not only does it fuck us over in these ways that are obvious to us, but it also makes us certain kinds of people. It turns us into certain kinds of subjects, and it works on our, it works at the level of our desires and how we feel. And that's the piece that is harder to see and harder to get at, but that I think is really at stake, especially in like the period of capitalism that we're in, where we're constantly through ads and social media and schooling and job pressures, kind of guided towards a really shitty, isolated form of life. And that we can come to desire all the, all those things. And so it's actually a battle over like how we feel and what we want for ourselves, and not just, or it's that in addition to the kind of more overt forms of violence and oppression.
Yeah. And the other way I've had it said to me that I really like is that, yeah, like we often talk about empire as this external thing, but it's also, but it also lives within us. So empire is both in us and it's outside of us. Mm-hmm. And the one that's in us is probably, is like, we all know what we want to do and how we want to do, but we don't really agree. The Maoists don't agree with, you know, the Marxists don't agree with the anarchists and so on and so forth on what to do about empire.
Can you talk about your analysis on, you know, comparing and critique?
Yeah. So one of the terms we use in the book is paranoid reading. And it comes from Eve Sedgwick, who's like kind of one of the early queer theorists writing in the 90s. And she has this really awesome, it was, I think it was originally an essay and then it got turned into a book chapter that it was, "You're so paranoid, you probably think this essay is about you." And she argues that like this is a dominant tradition within Western philosophy and theorizing on the, like on the left or on the radical side, that it privileges this form of critique that's linked to paranoia, that's trying to have kind of a a constant vigilance that is never wants to be caught off guard, never wants to seem naive, and is always looking for what might be wrong or bad or oppressive, and that and I think like I think the thing that she does that's interesting that we are also trying to do is to say that that critique can be really enabling and important. But it, maybe it's a question of like of dosage or of how it's used, because it can also be really corrosive when it's the only thing and when it forces out other ways of asking questions and being vulnerable and being curious. Because often when I'm in that like paranoid reading mode of not wanting to be caught off guard and searching for what might be wrong or bad, I'm not attuned to potential. I'm not able to be curious. I'm not able to be vulnerable because I have to force that out in order to do the paranoid thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that like figuring out that tension between the two, like the critical mind, and when it becomes disruptive and destructive to your life, is like the hard part is the work. Cause if I spend any time on social media, especially with my, like the American sort of progressive left, I like talk about that sad, militant, rigid radical just oozes up in me. And I just have like, I stop feeling creative and curious and I just feel pissed off. So, you know, like one of my strategies is maybe don't consume so much of that media, and start doing stuff with my friends here or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Click refresh on the sky.
Yeah. Right.
And well, what, well, two things that came to mind as you said that was, one was like the, Sylvia Federici part about, like one thing that always, can like make us feel better or can like increase our resolve or like, I don't know, like shore us up. It is to like, you know, think about history and to know our history, because they're always trying to take our history away. And if we can like, you know, place ourselves in a lineage of like, hey, people have been fighting for 400 years. These are the ones wins that people have gotten in the past, you know? Mm-hmm. And like the flip side of all of this that you talk about in your book is like, think about the potential, think about the possibilities. Like, sure, it doesn't meet all these criterias and, you know, whatever, but like, what are the potentialities there? What are the possibilities? And like, that really hit me because, again, I've been a sad militant as of late, and it just really like slapped me in the face. And I was like, all right. I'll mm-hmm. always look for the possibilities.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, and I really recommend, the thing that's given me the most hope these days is to uncover and read, and maybe it's not uncovering for other people, but to really search out and read works from people who weren't the typical charismatic leaders that were fed from history. Like, I agree with Sylvia Federici. I really can't say it enough. I get really upset when people, the phrase that upsets me, two phrases upset me more than anything. One is that it's never been done before, because it's usually not true. And back in the day, because it usually means they're gonna stop you from your experimentation. That didn't work back in the day.
Right.
Those are the two that upset me most. So I agree with her, but I also think that, you know, history, the way that we're spoon-fed it and stuff isn't always the best. And so, especially for trying to undo white supremacy and other forms of empire that are disastrous, and like whether it's patriarchy or whatever. So like really actively, not just looking back at history and the lineages, but like uncovering the voices and the people who aren't the white cis men or the charismatic leaders, because I think that's where the hope really lies, because it reminds us that it wasn't just two amazing people in that era that did the thing. It was hundreds of people who did it, who did real through subtle and care-driven, community-driven ways, the anti-hero or the anti-charismatic voice. I think I just really think that is one of the antidotes to, or the a way to get away from feeling sad and upset and pissed off at everybody in the world and comparing and critiquing.
Yeah, I think the other thing that that histories like Federici's helps me with is, like you said, like feeling connected to these legacies of struggle or whatever, because I think it's easy to learn about the horrors of colonialism and white supremacy and patriarchy and the witch trials and the international slave trade and the genocide of indigenous people and be like, holy crap, I'm from this toxic culture that brought all of this violence, and there's no way out. And I think, I mean, I kind of agree that there's no way out, but I think people like Sylvia Federici give us a place to start by recovering these stories of that divisions like the intensification of patriarchy through the witch trials and the introduction of white supremacy were intentional strategies to divide communities that were dangerous, like indentured servants were getting together with escaped slaves, were getting together with indigenous people, and they were starting to create a real threat to capitalism and to colonialism. And that's why these divisions exist in the first place. They existed to keep us divided and to keep us fucking each other over. And that, to me, there's like a lot of power there, because it's a reminder that people have always fought and that there have always been alliances.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I mean, you get it in Kropotkin's Mutual Aid. You get that story. You get the story that people had the capacity to take care of each other, show up for each other, and that the capitalists and the state intervened on purpose and created charities so that Mutual Aid would stop, because they saw it as a way of destroying their profit and their power. So that reading that like 20 whatever years ago was like, has been the strongest seed for me to believe in the big people's capacity to really show up and be there for each other, because that this is an external reason why we get destroyed or attempted to be destroyed.
So you were talking about social media being toxic. I don't relate to that at all. I just think it's like the best thing. It just brings out our, it brings the best out in everyone. But,
oh yeah, I never thought about it that way.
Whoa, that's so
cup
weird.
Half full.
you mean the algorithm's not neutral? That's so weird. You know, in your book, you talk about like overcoming fears and anxieties or whatever about like getting into this book, you know, for all the different reasons that, you know, the paranoid, all the different bad things that could happen or whatever. And, but I don't know if you saw this one coming. This person who, has been using your book as, to talk about like the cult of, you know, anarchism and to expose, and it's like really distorted your work. And he was interviewed on Fox News. And I guess I just wonder if you have anything to say about that or what lessons have come from that, or if you don't want to answer that, it's fine as well.
I mean, the one thing it makes me think of is that, like, this is one of the shitty things that happens because of rigid radicalism. Like, when people in radical communities tear each other apart, some people end up becoming reactionaries, right? And they're like, well, my shitty experience with rigid radicalism proves to me that the problem is radicalism itself, and therefore I'm going to become a pro-capitalist liberal now. Like, I think that's one of the outcomes of what happens when we develop these like toxic subcultures, is you end up with people, if they can, they'll go back to the comfy life that they were maybe in before they started a radical experiment in the first place. So to me, it's like a cautionary tale, I guess.
Yeah. But again, it's like, it's not a reason not to, you know, not to put this out there, because it's an important intervention right now, and people need to read this book, and people need to, you know, develop, you know, gain these tools for analyzing, you know, killing the sad militants in our head, you know.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. And yeah, it's definitely, I think that everybody since the beginning of the printing press has had their words morphed and used in different ways. And I think that's just comes with it. But I think what Nick has to say is the most important part, is that this is just one of the really shitty outcomes of rigid radicalism.
Right on.
Yeah. I think we also started to get, like, as we talked to more and more people, like both through interviews and we're just like, oh, this is the thing we're working on, started to realize that like the ideas that we're putting forward aren't new. You know, it's not like we dropped this idea that sometimes radical communities can be toxic to each other. these are like discussions that are ongoing. And so the most common reaction was like, oh, fucking thank God someone's actually going to talk about this publicly. And even the difference from when we started working on the book, it felt like this like really risky conversation to have, that like, no, we had read very little of anyone else talking about the phenomenon, to when we finished it felt like these conversations were already more public and there were already a bunch of articles that had kind of gone viral talking about it. And so it feels like the book is not getting at anything new or like developing some new analysis. It's hopefully just like maybe providing some tools to help, you know, keep discussions going.
Or pathways. I like to think that we provide some pathways or that we amplify some people's voices and ideas that are inspiring and that build our capacity to do and be more with each other. I mean, that's, I think, mm-hmm. our ultimate goal with the book in the end.
You know, I don't want to spoil anything in the book, but and I'm not just saying this, like I was like on the verge of crying when I read the stuff about gratitude, because I just felt like, oh my God, I just, you know, put myself through this rigorous process of like, you know, all these analyzing all these things in this part. But and then, but then, like, you know, when you're talking about gratitude in the book, and it's like, thank you for fighting for a better world. Thank you for putting yourself through all this neurotic shit to try to, like, you know, da da da. And I was like, oh my God, I've never been thanked for anything I've done in activism. And that felt really good. And wow, it's just a bunch of text but it really felt good. And I just love that part. I thought that was beautiful because gratitude is, like, so, you know, liberal or whatever. But, like, a while ago I was, like, processing the death of my dog, and I started doing some gratitude meditations, and it just, like, really helped me feel better. And I don't, like, meditate often, but, like, if I'm really depressed, I will. Mm-hmm. And and so I just love that y'all just, like, peppered that in there. I was like, oh, this is the shit. These people are awesome.
Aw, thanks for saying that. Thanks for giving back some gratitude.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm very gratitudinous towards y'all. Is there anything? I mean, like, you know, I cherry picked the stuff that I thought was really critical in your book that jumped out to me. But is there anything else with all of this that that I'm missing, or that you feel like, you know, listeners should think about, or, you know, is there anything else, like, on your heart through this conversation? You're like, you know, this is what I have to say at this point in the conversation.
Okay, I want to say that just thank you so much for the work you do, and for amplifying radical ideas and voices. And I think the more we hear from each other, the more our capacity to do more and to really chew on these ideas, but then actually do them, become more possible, because people like you are amplifying these voices. And that was my goal for the book, ultimately, was to affirm and hold up other ways of being, but not only in the future, but that have already been going on for centuries and decades and weeks and years. And I just really wanted to share that with everybody. And hopefully there's so many other people doing that work too. And just, yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, one last thing. I always ask people to recommend a book. So since there's two of y'all, you can each recommend a book that you're loving or you think people should.
I'll just say To Our Friends by the Invisible Committee, because that book helped me think through a lot of the stuff that led to our book. And I think it's really great. Yeah.
Hear, hear.
I can't remember the name of it. The Esteva and
Grassroots Postmodernism.
Yeah, Grassroots Postmodernism, because I think there's a lot in there about conviviality and hospitality and trust and responsibility and friendship and prefiguration. That's has a global Latin America and India, and just pulls us out of our white North American Western thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm going to say The Dispossessed because
I was going to, too.
Because you were, when you started tweeting about it, I was like, oh shit, like, what does this mean? She's tweeting about The Dispossessed. Like, that's awesome. That's the opposite of Militant Joy. So people should read that, because that's like the 1984 for anarchists, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
But the other books in that series are pretty good, too. There's some, have you read them all?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I'm a big fan.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for coming on. And if people want to support your work and go buy this book and, you know, follow y'all, what's the best way?
Okay. So the book is through AK Press. And then we have a website, joyfulmilancy.com. And we have some excerpts on there and the full interviews. I'm at Joyful Carla on Twitter and Instagram. And Montgomery.
Nick, are you on Twitter? I was trying to find you, Nick. I couldn't.
I have a Twitter account, but I don't really use it.
Yeah,
it's Many Politics, but I don't actually tweet.
Good for you.
So our website is the best if you're interested in this book or being in touch with us. There's a way to contact us through there.
Awesome. Well, hey, thanks. Thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate you. Really appreciate this book. And I hope the rest of your weekend is full of joy.
Yeah, you too. Congratulations on your life stuff news. Take care.
One hand in your pocket while yours is in the air, screaming, we know life ain't fair, we don't care. This one's for the so-called ruling class. Who you gonna fool with that totality? You built it, Leviathan, don't kill it. I'm an owner in the squatter, aka the Senate, from a race of colonizers. No sins forgiven, holy water, no Catholic guilt. Make the world a better place, nah, it's too real for that shit. We don't love a quick escape, that's your bloody legacy. You better own it, only thing that changes what's to come, and war is still here. If you want it, ain't the 1800s, all that clever shit's been written. If you wanna make it out this hell, better start digging. Your heroes have no answers, know your enemies, or your false friends, or some dead philosophers who knew the world before TV was a thing. Don't call me comrade, either we are friends or we are not. For we have in common, taking cops, and if they wish to smash the state, well that's not enough. We'll never find the beach beneath the streets if we can't relate. Carry recent deaths since I hit the streets. Too many last breaths. So sit around, dying of thirst, neck deep in water. We stand with those who walk around in the night, consumed by fire. But fire needs kindle, my hands tremble. No sober truth to God's symbol. Cause we ain't even born free. From the womb to the tomb, from empty room to empty womb. I to live and fight, I to not burn out but burn bright. Maybe burn ain't the word for the 2020s when the fight's back in a real way. Territory, no more gestures. Fuck the news and it's just as what they sell is boredom and empty like successes on yourself. We preparing for the worst. Human God has to offer not much more than I can do right now, but put it in reverse. I ain't got no crystal ball. All I know is I'll never kneel if I pull that final straw.